to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwendinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a lovely five-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk more about some recent news headlines and hopefully provide some insight and analysis of practical application that you can take back into the office to help protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
So Matt, do you think there's an insurance company in Nigeria that's declining to reimburse damages for a prison break due because they failed to enforce their gun-free zones?
No reply to that. I was trying to think of one on the fly and I have no reply to that.
The answer is probably.
Probably.
All signs point to yes.
All right. For our first article today, we're going to talk insurance. And I know how much you guys know we love insurance, all 10 listeners. Travelers wants out of contract with insured that allegedly misrepresented multi-factor auth use. This is an insurance journal. This is a new one for us. We're branching out. We're also covering prison breaks. So this is a multidisciplinary episode. As a summary, an electronics manufacturing company, International Control Service, was ransomwared in May. They submitted a cyber insurance claim, drink, to Travelers Insurance to cover their expenses. Travelers is asking the local district court to allow them to rescind their policy, claiming they lied on their paperwork. They said that ICS said they used MFA for admin privileged access when they only used it to access their firewalls. So therefore, they want the court to declare the policy null and void.
Case closed.
Case closed. So, I mean, it is a fairly simple, I'm sure that the ransomware is complex and there's complex questions that are coming out of this, but really I've had some discussions with some people that whose judgment I respect and, you know, including you, we talked about this on Wednesday and I texted you when I saw it, but how do you represent a complex network where you don't necessarily have the same level of controls across the entire network in a single questionnaire where the question is going to be, do you use MFA for admin privilege access? Yes or no?
Well, if that's the question, then the answer is yes, which is obviously what ICS said. Do you like pizza?
Yes. But not if it has pineapple on it or anchovies.
I completely agree.
Or both.
That null and voids the pizza.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the question, right? Is that's what the insurance companies are using, a simple questionnaire to try and ascertain a very, very complex state of a very complex network.
I was actually surprised that the question was that simplistic and not much more complex to start with.
Well,
about ransomware, you're talking about, you know, potentially millions of dollars achieved.
Well, hold on. How would you phrase the question? So let's take that single question. Do you use MFA for administrative or privileged access? How would you change that single question?
How I would word it, considering we're talking about ransomware, which is primarily a problem involving Windows workstations and servers, is I would state the question is, do you use multi-factor authentication to access servers and workstations?
Then you probably have to answer no, because most people don't use MFA to access workstations. So would you like divide it up into a bunch of different questions? Like, do you use MFA servers?
They could be two different questions. I want to get that specificity. Do you use MFA to access servers? Do you use MFA to access, or better yet, which of the following require multi-factor authentication? And then you have a list.
Check.
And domain controllers, Windows servers, application servers, workstations, or whatever. And you just come up with the list and the insurance company then can assign some kind of weighting to those things and then they tally it or something like that and get a weighted answer at the end. I mean, insurance companies should know better, to be honest. In which case, if I was the judge, I'd be like, no, you guys failed to ask the correct question. So you got the answer that you don't like, and now you have to live with that. So that's what I would do if I were the judge, but of course I'm not. Because I think if the judge does throw this out, in either case, I think regardless of the way the judge rules in this instance, this is going to have some pretty serious repercussions for the way cyber insurance policies are written. Because apparently they're written much more poorly than I thought they were. I've never actually seen one in person, so I can't speak to what one actually looks like. But based on this whole scenario here, and Travelers is not a tiny mom and pop place either. That's a serious one of the major providers in the United States.
Well, you know how I phrased my question about having that single question? I spoke with somebody who filled out one of these, and that was their comment, was that you frequently will have a single question that will be expected to cover all of your systems. So it sounds like that is the way that they write these questions. You will get a single question about whether you use MFA everywhere or nowhere. And that's just how they phrase them.
If I were an insurance company and I provided a questionnaire to a company around cyber insurance, and they were writing a book and answer that questionnaire in a day, I would say that questionnaire is either too simple or they're lying to me, because the information that you need to consume in order to make an accurate
judgment.
Right. Yeah. In order to make a full assessment of what the real risk profile of that company is, I mean, it's not something you could do properly in a questionnaire which you can complete in one day.
That's interesting. Because I worry that if its questionnaire is too detailed, then people aren't gonna actually fill it out.
Well, then they're not going to get their ransomware insurance.
What happens if you've got subsidiaries or you've got portions of the network that are, like, let's say your policy is to use MFA on all servers, and the attackers found like a subdomain where there were 5 servers that didn't have MFA. Do you think that should wipe out your entire policy?
Or, if it's in scope, I would say, yeah.
Interesting. That would force us to a higher level of maturity. Because if you're going to lose, you know, $2 to $5 million worth of coverage, now all of a sudden it's worth it to actually get out there and figure out where there's holes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you and I have talked several times about how insurance really needs to start driving with this more. And I think this court case, like I said, either way the judge rules on this, I think will be impactful for this going forward.
Yeah. So I have a list of some other ways that insurance companies might do a better job of accommodating these complexities. And we talked about the more complicated questionnaires a little bit. What about putting their own scan engines in the environment? What if they put their own Nessus or Rapid7 engines in the environment? We know how effective vulnerability scanning is, but it would give them more information than a questionnaire.
Yeah, I think what you could do is, you're not going to be able to get away from using the questionnaire, but I think what you might be able to say is maybe you have a questionnaire and you'll say, this section of the questionnaire, you can either answer the questionnaire or allow us to do this, this, and this. So that they could say, you know, if you allow us to tap into your vulnerability management software, mm-hmm. And see what your vulnerability management program actually looks like or something like that, maybe you don't have to answer pages 5 through 7 or something like that.
And then putting their own scan engines in there, you just pass them the results to your vulnerability management program?
I'm just saying that these are some of the options out there. Where you can say, because for the insurance company, what they want is information about what's going on. And there are different ways to get it. And directly from the application will probably be the most efficient and the most effective way to get it. So I think not only would you, if you were able to demonstrate by providing them access to your vulnerability management tool, that you were serious about the way that you're performing vulnerability management, you know, not only would that answer the question that they were going to ask in the questionnaire, but that might provide them the additional fidelity for them to decide to lower your premium.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are, you know, there's obviously some risk involved with exposing that to a third party, but I think it's obviously trade-offs just like anything else in security.
Yeah, that makes sense. Next option, insurance pen testing. Before you can get your insurance, you have to let them pen test you.
Yeah, or provide something like a SOC 2 type report from a pen tester on their short list or something like that.
Yeah, or maybe they may say pen test puppy mill.
Yeah, or they may say, here's a list of pen testers that we accept results from or something like that. And you say, pick one and provide us this document, which they've already, because what they might do is, you know, they'll have a pen test company that they trust. So they'll say, if you pick this pen test company will go conduct their pen test and they'll produce 2 reports, one for the customer and one for the insurance company, which they've already ironed out the details in that reporting for that or something along those lines.
That's what I was thinking about for the vulnerability management is now you've got to maintain 2 sets of books, just like the Trump Corp did.
You mean what most corps do?
What most?
ask Enron. Oh, you can't because they're defunct.
Next one, connecting to the SEM. We talked about this before when we were talking. Oh, what were we talking about? We're talking about something. We're talking about how the government and the insurance companies would want to look into your, like, have a direct connection to your SEM so they could run their analytics in there.
Oh, and, that was the reporting requirement, the 72-hour reporting requirement or something like that.
I saw something else recently. Somebody recently passed a 48-hour reporting requirement, and I shook my head, and I was like, I don't want to talk about this again.
I said they're going to keep getting shorter and shorter.
It's going to be like 30 minutes.
Well, it's like I said, they're going to want real-time feeds eventually.
Boy. Oh, boy. Black box, a breach and attack simulation, continuous validation, where they stick a breach and attack simulation box inside the network and then continuously test it. We talked about that a bit a while ago.
Yeah, and of course, we've already seen the ransomware riders on insurance policies that separate that out. So maybe you get a questionnaire for regular cyber insurance, which excludes ransomware. And then if you want to include the ransomware with a rider or an addendum or whatever, then there's another questionnaire you have to fill out that's more detailed and has more stringent requirements or something like that. And, you know, one of the things also, you know, we were just talking about the fidelity of the insurance, the information the insurance company allowing them to lower your premiums. It could be that, you know, if they are unable to get these questionnaires to provide them the details that they need, then maybe rates are just going to go up because they have to add additional risk in there, which they can't quantify or understand.
Huh. Yeah, could be. So why does this matter? Well, are CISOs everywhere suddenly feeling a chill when they realize that a lot of the questions, depending on how this comes back, may be enough to get their insurance dropped if they were not 100% accurate all the way across the environment, especially if you're a very large company with diverse networks that may not have consistent controls across every network?
Right. I mean, because right now, a CISO should be paying attention to this, because if the judge rules that the travelers can throw that out, then what's that mean for the coverage that you have right now? Is it good or not? You know, you're not going to be sure. So you'd have to, the CISO should probably get with the legal team and go back over your insurance policy with a fine-tooth comb to see how this impacts you. Or maybe even you bring the insurance company in and you renegotiate, you talk over that contract again.
It'd be really interesting to look at. If they do any of those other things, like we just talked about with the insurance companies, that'd be a really interesting job to be at the insurance companies, to be collating those. Like collating like the vulnerability information, the pen testing information for various companies. But we've talked about that before.
Yeah. Anyways. I mean, I'd actually really like to get a job at an insurance company dealing with cyber insurance. I think it's a burgeoning field. I think that, it could be extremely interesting depending on how all this fleshes out.
Yeah. And then on the other side are insurance companies everywhere suddenly realizing that a questionnaire isn't getting them good enough information to actually realize how good the security is.
I wonder if they didn't already know that answer.
I'm sure they have after the last year. They probably already knew that. Although the question is, they just haven't figured out what to move to.
Yeah. Well, time will tell. We'll see what the judge says.
Yep. So what should you do about it? If you haven't seen this yet, like, David just said, it's time to go find this article. It's time to go get your insurance policy. It's time to go get your question and answer document and time to figure out if the answers you gave were true of 100% of your environment or not. And it's time to maybe pay a little attention to this case and see how it comes out.
Yeah, because one of the things that we may not have a clear distinction here is that the problem is the difference between what the company believes was the truthful answer and what the insurance company believed was the truthful answer. And if those two things don't marry up, because the company may not, depending on how you read it, people may think the company was being deceitful in the way that they answered that question, but they may not have been. That may have been the way that they actually interpreted that question and felt that they were answering it truthfully. So when you're reviewing your existing policy, you can attempt to look at that from someone else's perspective as well, or maybe have someone look over your answers and see if they understand them the same way that you understand them. I'm not saying some other company or some other third party unless you want to engage like a third party legal consultant or something like that, but someone outside of your normal legal team or cybersecurity team, maybe you should ask them to review the questions and see if they believe the questions are asking what they're asking and that you've answered them the way they would expect to be answered as well. which brings us to our second article, which is quite, it's a doozy. So the bill for U.S. telcos to bin Chinese kit blows out by $3 billion. And if you can't tell by that oddly worded headline that doesn't make sense in America, this comes to us from the Register. What they're trying to say here is the cost of doing this is going to cost way more than originally it was intended.
Surprise.
All right. So in February of 2020, the government passed a bill called the Secure and Trust Communications Network Act of 2019, with the SAT-CNA, to prevent federal subsidies from being used to buy equipment from what they call high-risk vendors, which is Huawei and ZTE, both which are Chinese companies. But the problem is that they tried to close the barn door after the horse was already out, because a whole bunch of telcos already are using that equipment. So they said, oh, well, that's not a problem. We will give you $1.9 billion to help replace that gear. And the telcos came back and said, oh, that's awesome, except for you're shorting us $3 billion. We need another $3 billion really to do all this replacement, which is interesting because, you know, I don't know if this is a good news story or not, because originally in February, the telco said, oh, it's going to cost us $5.6 billion, but now it's only going to cost $4.9 billion. So there's an upside there.
Government can print that in like a month.
Oh, they could print that in a day. Now, presses wouldn't even get. So who's affected by this is what they call providers of advanced communication services, who are servicing less than 2 million customers. So this is not even the really huge telcos. This is just local telcos that are being given this money. Can you imagine if like AT&T or the big ones had to replace any Huawei equipment or whatever? I wouldn't expect them to have very many. So maybe that's kind of a moot point that only the smaller carriers are even really affected by this at all. Because this is anybody who provides high-speed switch broadband telecommunication capabilities that enables users to originate and receive high-quality voice, data, graphics, and video. So very simple, straightforward government definition there.
I found it interesting. There were 181 applications for funds, but 122 were not completed correctly. I don't know if that means there was too complicated of an application or...
My guess is this is a delaying tactic by the government. Hmm. In the article, it said that they had material deficiencies, which including a lack of adequate cost estimates or sufficient supporting materials to justify the amount being requested, which is obviously open to interpretation, because that says, oh, well, this is not adequate. And, you know, what does that mean? Not adequate. So I think it's a delaying tactic by the government, other than someone who, you know, the, what is it, 19 companies that dotted every I and crossed every T. So I'm wondering if what happened here is that the government came up with that $9 billion, but that said, hey, you know, a Huawei switch with 48 ports on it costs this much. So what's a Cisco switch of comparable 48 ports cost? They said, okay, let's estimate that out. And that's where they came up with the $1.9 billion. Or maybe they had a dartboard and they threw it, and that's where they came up with the number or something. Because if you worked in corporate America at all, at least this has been my experience anyway, is that when anybody's talking about a project to introduce a new software, new hardware to the organization, that it's virtually never happens where they talk about OpEx in addition to CapEx. And so capital expense versus operational expense. So they'll say that Cisco switch costs, you know, $2,500, but they also won't incorporate in the number of man hours necessary to take that Huawei switch out and put that Cisco switch in the proper configuration to ensure that the routing and switching still happens after that's done, which is generally more than the cost of the device. So I think that's where we're seeing the cost inflation here. And the government, because they're a bunch of idiots, are assuming that the companies are simply trying to steal from them. Quote unquote. You know, they're trying to get more from the government than they think is necessary. So they think they're padding these requests. That's my guess anyway. So of course the question, why is the government so terrified of Huawei and ZTE?
Because the Chinese are bad. Just like So I actually did some searching on this because I was curious about this, because I feel like we've been hearing lots and lots of verbiage from the government on why Huawei and ZTE. I hadn't heard much about ZTE, but I heard about Huawei is bad, Huawei is bad, Huawei is bad. Take them out, take them out, take them out. And I actually did find a separate CNN article that had some more information. I'm not going to dive into all of this because we're running a little short on time tonight. For those of you that don't know, we record these on Saturday nights. And Saturday nights, I also go grocery shopping because I'm a super exciting human being.
But you may have already heard his stomach rumbling.
They did release some information where the FBI and the other federal agencies said they have found Huawei-made equipment on cell towers near U.S. military bases in the Midwest along I-25 that could capture and disrupt defense communications, including those used by STRATCOMs, which, of course, is the U.S. military command that controls the nukes. When they looked into this, they said a couple of different things. They said, number one, it's very difficult to tell without taking down and completely tearing apart the equipment to tell if it can or cannot transmit on frequencies that it's not supposed to. Huawei said that, no, of course it doesn't transmit on those frequencies. We would never do that. They also sold the equipment to the Midwest telco at a rate that seemed unprofitable to Huawei. My thought was maybe it was a loss leader, but it's a very small telco though. Why would they do this as a loss leader when this telco is not a very large one? They're not, you know, anticipating a much larger sale later. The Midwest telco, I think that was called Viero. The CEO, Frank DiRico, says that they monitor our network pretty good. We feel we've got a pretty good idea if there's anything going on that's inappropriate. I highly doubt that, buddy. I highly doubt that you monitor your network well enough to tell if somebody is backdooring your stuff. But sure, the Chinese government denies any efforts to spy on the U.S., of course.
Well, it's not like we spy on them, so...
Well, no, I know. I totally get it. This is part of the game. Like, we spy on them, they spy on us. I harbor no ill will towards them for trying. And frankly, I think it's a really intelligent and really... Did you read that article? Did you get a chance to read that one?
No, I did not.
Okay, no, it started with actually a really interesting anecdote where China volunteered to build a really cool garden in DC, but they were going to have to ship certain parts of the garden through government pouches, through diplomatic pouches. And when the FBI looked into it, they discovered it was going to be built on the highest point in DC. And basically they figured out that China was going to put a bunch of signals intelligence equipment in it. And they were putting it at the highest point so they could just intercept signals from all across DC. So like, no, it's a game. I totally get it. And they do it very well. I'm impressed.
Yeah. Well, America must be better at it, though, because you don't hear a lot of accusations.
That's because our media.
Well, that could be. Because you don't hear a lot of accusations coming the other way, which could be, like you said, just the media completely filtering them all out. Because you hear all the time about, you know, these Russian hackers were caught, these Chinese hackers were caught. You don't hear a lot about American hackers being caught. Because you'd think you'd hear some, at least something, right, from Russian or Chinese news agencies about it. But of course, at least with, you know, you're not going to hear anything from Russian news agencies now, since the America's pretty much banned them from communicating with Americans just about. But I've always thought that that's pretty interesting. Either, you know, maybe they just have a different concept about the way that they don't want to tout these things when they do catch Americans. Because I find it improbable that we're so skillful that the Americans don't get caught doing it.
Maybe we're just better at throwing off the scent. Maybe people just keep thinking it's someone else.
Well, I mean, it was released in the Vault 7 leaks that they had. And what's that program called now? I forget. They had a program that came out in the Vault 7 leaks, which is designed to make whatever actions take place on a device look like a specific threat actor.
Nice.
So it could be that, you know, that's really what our secret sauce is making everybody think it's not us by... We're dropping the most incorrect breadcrumbs on there. But I think this really all stems from a Bloomberg article in October of 2018 called The Big Hack, How China Used a Tiny Chip to Infiltrate U.S. Companies. And according to that article, the attack by Chinese spies reached almost 30 U.S. companies, including Amazon and Apple, compromising America's technology supply chain, according to extensive interviews with government and corporate sources. Now, this article has widely been refuted by virtually everybody. And actually, Bloomberg at the very bottom of the article had to add this caveat, which says Bloomberg LP has been a super micro customer. According to a Bloomberg LP spokesperson, the company has found no evidence to suggest it has been affected by the hardware issues raised in the article. And if you remember back at the time, this was huge. This was a really big deal. Everybody was talking about this. Everybody was freaked out that the Chinese were this sophisticated. And with all the technology that we get from China, with all the American factories, you know, Apple has a lot of factories over there for the iPhones and everything. Everybody was terrified that the Chinese were in our knickers, and we had no idea that it was even taking place. So after this thing came out, Supermicro's share price completely tanked. But after everyone's rebuttals came out, it was able to move or rise back up to where it had been before, because both Amazon and Apple both said this was complete bunk. And as a matter of fact, Tim Cook said, it is 100% a lie. There is no truth to it. But I think because of the hype around it at the time and the fact that it came from Bloomberg, which a lot of government people really have a lot of faith in, I think this is really what spurred the whole idea for this law to begin with.
Yeah, I remember that was crazy. Everybody was talking about that for like a week and then it just disappeared.
Yeah. And some of the articles that I read when I was researching this also said that the two people whose byline were on this, because there was so much pushback on the quality of this and everything, they didn't write anything for months after this article because of the reputation hit that they took on this article. But there's a link in the show notes to an article that was written last year that says Bloomberg still stands by this article even today. Even though everybody, including Apple, Amazon, and even the DHS, said it's bulk.
Interesting. All right. Well, why does this matter? Well, I mean, I think it's pretty much understood at this point in time that the Chinese government and Chinese business kind of work arm in arm. But I think a lot of American companies and American government work arm in arm as well. So,
yeah. Well, it also matters because that $5 billion, that's where your inflation's coming from. Every dollar the U.S. prints reduces the purchasing power of the dollar that's in your pocket. So the more...
three of those dollars in my pocket.
Well, I've got two nickels that are up together. So at least you've got paper. But every time the government comes out with these edicts and saying that they, you know, you have to do this and here's the money to do it, all that money adds to these problems. That's why they call it inflation a tax.
Yeah. So, and what can you do about it? Whew, I'm not even sure. We're so inextricably linked with China. Like, they do all our manufacturing. It's not even like we could buy tech that's not Chinese at this point, right? I mean, I know there's a couple factories, a couple fabs that you can get. I know Taiwan's got a big chip fab, but it's tough to buy tech that's not Chinese, right?
Yeah, most of the semiconductors are coming from Taiwan.
Glad I have you on here because you're smarter than I am and know more than I do. That's why you're on this podcast.
That's not true, but thanks. Because actually, this reminds me of, you remember, man, it's probably been 10 years now, when that the Western Digital factory in Vietnam burned down.
Yeah.
And how that caused skyrocketing hard drive prices at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, because we've offshored a lot of technical construction to Asia now for just about anything technical. You know, we do, obviously, Intel and AMD are American companies that develop the CPUs and everything like that. But the manufacturing of these intricate technical pieces are mostly overseas. We don't manufacture a lot of technical things in the United States anymore.
Yeah. They're apparently the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company is working with Intel to build a fab in Arizona starting in 2024, supposedly.
Probably solar powered.
Well, that would be convenient there.
In Arizona, it would be. It gets kind of warm there.
Yeah, apparently, it's going to need a lot of water, though. So, less convenient.
Oh.
Yeah. In the midst of a multi-decade.
Yeah, actually, I had not thought about that part of it.
Well.
So, yeah, it's the whole trade-off. Now, sure, we get great solar energy from this, but we don't get the water necessary in order to produce this.
It's going to be the first fab in the U.S. to make 5-nanometer chips. Anyways. All right. The third article is a Nigerian prison break article brought to us from Bruce Schneier's blog. He links to I think it was an MSN article. This is not really in our wheelhouse, but it was super interesting. So we want to talk about it a little bit at the end of the day here today.
The MSN article was just a copy and paste of a Daily Beast article.
Was it really?
Yeah.
It's disappointing. I guess I shouldn't be, I should expect that. I should expect that these days. Militants in Abuja, Nigeria, attacked a prison and freed 800 prisoners, including 64 jihadists. One of them was the leader of a terrorist group called Ansaru. I found it amusing in the picture. The leader of the terrorist group is wearing a Timberland polo. The attack was claimed by ISWAP. I have no idea if that's how you pronounce that. Islamic State, West African province. The militants were armed with bombs, RPGs, and machine guns, although apparently the facility was heavily fortified as well. There were 30 armed guards at the prison. 4 prisoners and 1 guard were killed during the attack, although the attack was carried out by hundreds of members. A different article said 300 people. The Ow. Deadly terrorist group. Yeah, how did only 1 guard get killed? 300... although I guess 300 attackers versus 30 armed guards, the guards probably saw it and just were like, nope, nope.
Not today.
Not today. They don't pay me enough. I can't pay you enough to try and fight back against that. There's no amount of money you could pay me to run towards that amount of gunfire.
Yeah, I mean, who would expect an attack of that, you know, that level on the prison?
That is... That's a company size. That's like 2 companies worth of attackers. Yeah. So you put a note in here. The attackers had so much free time on their hands. They first delivered a 15-minute Quran lecture to inmates before setting them free. I mean, I guess at that point, the guards had surrendered, so they had all the time they wanted.
Well, this took place near the capital of Nigeria. And sure, there's only 30 guards there, but where is the rest of the law enforcement and the military around where these people were not in a hurry to exfiltrate all these prisoners, you know, because there's a saying among cops in America, anyhow, you might be able to outrun me, but you can't outrun the radio. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of surprised that either there was not enough time for any kind of additional support to be called in or anything like that to minimize the effects of this, considering how close it was to the capital city.
Nigerian prison service, Kuj. Yeah, it's not actually in Abuja, but it is real close. You can see it on Google Maps, although it has not been updated to show
the hole in the wall.
Yeah, it's in a town.
Because imagine if they were able to give a 15-minute lecture, how long did this actually play out over? I didn't read any of the article about how long it took, but my guess would be that it took a few hours at least. In one of the articles, or maybe it was in the Daily Beast article, they said that they were actually looking for a particular prisoner that they wanted to kill who was a former cop, that they spent some time trying to find this guy. And only after they failed to find them did they give up and leave.
So there's a Nigerian Air Force base 33 minutes to the north, and there's actually a barracks 27 minutes to the north. So yeah, so they had probably an hour. So the attackers, so their reinforcements an hour away.
Yeah, so maybe they just built that into their timeline. Said, well, we have an hour to get this done.
Interesting. I didn't think about that. Yeah. So 400 of the fugitives have been caught. So that's good. Although none of the jihadists have been caught, which is not good. But the reason Bruce Schneier brought it up was about threat modeling. His suggestion was that the defenders got the threat model wrong. He was thinking about prisoners and not war, not company level attacks. The article did say it was a heavily fortified prison. There was a picture of it. It had, you know, concrete walls with concertina wire across the top. But again, 30 guards is not a ton of guards, and they were probably armed with rifles and pistols, not necessarily machine guns, and probably not RPGs.
Right. It's kind of like the difference between housing criminal prisoners and prisoners of war.
Yeah. So that's what I was looking at. It said it's a medium security prison. Why would you put jihadists into a medium security prison?
I don't know. I didn't read. There was quite a bit of detail in there about a particular fellow that was in there, but I kind of skimmed over that because I was more interested in the details about the actual attack. So I didn't look into what his background was and what he was in prison for, because it could be a matter of one of those bureaucratic nuances where they got him on tax evasion so they couldn't justify putting him in a real prison or, you know, a more secure location or something like that, maybe.
This is the leader of the group who connection and death with an Italian engineer. Bunch of people they killed. So why does this matter? Are your threat models wrong? Are you worrying about the wrong things right now? Are you worried about prisoners and you should be worried about an army showing up at your door?
Well, I think one of the questions might be, in the context of this article is they were threat modeling criminal prisoners and essentially prisoners of war together. You know, so are you threat modeling two things that are similar, but aren't the same thing, where the threat models might actually be different?
Well, I think there's a very concrete example we can use here that we've been talking about a lot lately. Everybody's incredibly worried about ransomware, and ransomware is a huge impact for your company. But when we looked at the FBI report back at the beginning of the year, it found that business email compromise was actually the one that was more impactful in terms of actual dollar value. It's not as impactful to business processes because it's not shutting systems down. It's not, shutting all your computers down for a month while you try and rebuild everything. But in terms of like pure dollar loss, it is more impactful.
Right. You might say that the ransomware is more obvious. It's more visual. You can see it more readily than you can see the business email compromises more on the back end. It's not as in your face as a ransomware attack.
So the business email compromise, heck, if you're in security, you may not know about it. It may just be happening and the business side may not be telling you that it's happening.
Or maybe one of the situations where they stole something from you. You don't even realize it for months yet because you're still trying to get money from whoever they told you to send that invoice to.
Yeah. Yep.
Still waiting for whatever they said they were selling you to show up and it's not showing up. Or however, business email compromise can encompass any number of kind of scenarios there, many of which or several of which are delayed where you aren't going to realize you've been taken until it's been some time.
Yep. So now it's just a good time to re-examine your assumptions. It's just your annual reminder to figure out if you're worried about the most important thing right now. That's all. All right. Anything else for today?
Nope. Set your calendar. We'll be giving this a reminder again next year in case you
assuming
forget.
There's another prison break article or something fun. Not fun might be the wrong word. I may edit that out.
Entertaining.
We've been laughing a lot today, but actually it's been kind of
very somber.
Yes. Anyways, thank you for listening to the Security Serengeti podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Serengeti Sec and subscribe and listen on your favorite podcast app.